Okay, we'll get started. This is day two of the series on simple living. How many people were not here yesterday? Okay, so I'll reintroduce myself. My name is Ann Basie, and I left my book in my room, but I did write a book on simplicity. It's up in the bookstore called Sustaining Simplicity, a Journal, that was commissioned by the ELCA World Hunger Appeal. So that's sort of my credential here. You can buy it at the bookstore. And I've been talking and to different church groups about simplicity for a couple of years since that book came out. And so I have a whole series this week to talk about. And my format is kind of to talk for a while and then leave a lot of time for discussion. We had quite a lot of discussion yesterday, and I took notes. I wrote down the notes that we wrote on the board, and I think that some of the themes that came up yesterday in our intro session will inform some of the other sessions that we're doing this week. But this is the one that I called Powers and Principalities. Systems, I guess. Systems and values would be another name for it. And so I'm just going to talk a while, okay? And then we'll switch to conversation later. So when I wrote the book was about the year 2005 in my life. Just for those of you who aren't here, what the World Hunger Appeal said to do was write a book that didn't tell you why you should live a simple life, didn't tell you how you should live a simple life, but just kind of showed the life of somebody who lives that way, walking through the world, making decisions, and living. So that's why it has kind of a journal format. That was just to invite people more than to scold or nag, which the church can be good at doing. So I really enjoyed presenting about the book for a couple of years, and then I got all cranky last fall and became a terrible presenter after a couple things happened. I finally saw the Al Gore movie. And, you know, that was a real wake-up call for people. Like, oh, global warming, it's really happening. And actually, that hadn't even been talked about in my book. And then the market crashed, and it just seemed like we all really needed to be doing this. And so I was sort of thinking, what's the problem? How come people aren't getting this? And then I also was having a hard time at the ELCA Churchwide, where until a couple weeks ago I was part of the Global Mission Unit. Kind of as the resident green liver simple living person, I was often involved in discussions in the building about how we could make it a greener place with more environmental consciousness, which was very personally frustrating for me. It's working out well. You know, big institutions have to systematize things, and now things are getting systematized, and that's good. But I was just turning into the worst crank. I would, you know, stand next to the recycling, to stand next to the garbage and take out somebody's lunch can, soup can that they hadn't recycled, and in front of everybody, rip off the paper and rinse it off and stick it in the garbage, or people would turn on the water and walk away and do something, and I'd come in and turn off the water. I was sort of turning into the village crank about simplicity and green living, and then on reflection, I realized that, you know, in my own life, and just sort of some highlights of how I've been living, don't have a car, but that's a very easy thing to do in Chicago, not a lot of worldly goods, spend more time than money. Just kind of was a gradual process of simplification, and you could see the details in the book. But I realized that having made those choices, I had built systems around them so I could live that way. So I don't have a car, but I didn't wake up in the morning thinking, oh my gosh, I have no car. How will I get to work? Because I had kind of figured that out, right? There could be a bike, there could be a bus, there could be a train, there could be a colleague. There are a whole different ways, a whole system supporting my decision not to have a car. And then I realized that at work then, in the office environment, there was no system, and that was what was making me so cranky, because it was just sort of me, the lone person, saying, would you please think about recycling that soup can? They've made a lot of progress. Don't worry, Churchwide is getting a lot better. I was especially cranky because I thought, this is where we're issuing all those statements on care of creation, and, you know, and we're not living it very well, but we're getting better, much, much better. So I started to really focus on systems and what that meant, you know, how you can kind of decide, I would like to live a little simpler life, and then you can figure out what you need to do to make that happen. But in other places, like work, that's a harder thing to do. At Holden, it's easy. I mean, you know, the simple life is not really simple here. We're working really hard to make it simple for everybody else. But there are systems and processes and a whole routine that helps make the fresh bread and get the garbage sorted. And so it was an interesting thing for me to kind of move from thinking about personal choice to system. So then I started to focus from, kind of move from simple, from personal choice to structural support or lack of structural support. And yesterday somebody did mention during our initial discussion that there, how difficult it is to share because there's not much infrastructure for sharing. A lot of infrastructure for personal purchases, not much infrastructure in our culture for sharing. So I started to think kind of culturally about who we are and why we're the way we are and that we've built these systems that support car consumption and everything else we do. So for that then, we'll move to the discussion with my co-presenter. So if you take a look at this bottle, this product, I think you can take a look. In this bottle are a lot of values that our American lens contains. Does anybody want to name? Like what, if you look at that bottle, what kind of American value would you see in that?
The drinking water out of your tap isn't safe.
Isn't safe, okay.
Oil. Yeah.
Hmm? Oil.
Oil, the oil it took to make the plastic?
Convenience.
Convenience.
Convenience, yeah.
Transportation.
Marketing, that it's a market had been, you know, you don't just turn on the water to fill up your glass, it's been marketed that you need to buy the Coca-Cola brand.
The transportation.
Non-disposable.
Well, we think it's disposable.
Disposable.
Right.
Yeah.
Disposable. Convenient.
The ones that are left half filled.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere.
Waste.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So how about the value of portability? You can take it with you.
Mm-hmm. But you can. We have containers.
Yeah, you can.
Take our water with
We're just analyzing our culture using the lens of the plastic bottle right now.
I think it just kind of speaks to our capitalism and entrepreneurship. That's
yeah.
So, I mean, in some ways, I look at that and think, wow, somebody would really have
somebody bottled water and they made money out of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It's not even Coca-Cola. It's water. Yeah. It's yes. I left my little cards of incredible statistics about how much we spend on that and what the actual cost per ounce is of this, even compared to a gallon of gasoline, but it's really high. So, yeah, there's a convenience, individualism, right? One serving, mobility, disposability, all those things. Kind of. So what do you not see? Can you see... If you thought about what American values or structures surround us, like what would be missing from this?
Economy.
Because
it's huge waste of user. It's not waste. That's a giant, but it's a user of resources.
Okay.
Get with a lot less.
Okay.
Output.
So a sense of economy in the sense not of giant Wall Market, of Wall Street, but the economy of a household. Uh huh. Any other? What else?
Duplication or something like that.
Duplication?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think humility, because it's kind of like you're smart enough and good enough to create something that's not out of the tap.
Yeah. So humility is lacking.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Trust in the water.
Ah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
I think there's a fair amount of fashion in it.
Mm-hmm.
You see these people drink it.
That's changed, though. I mean, overnight, it's like changed from badge of honor to badge of disgrace. It's really happening. So, I mean, you can see that in the sales of in the campaigns against water bottles. So it's like, it was fashionable, but it's not
So it's
today.
Not now as much?
No, I think it depends on the age group, too. We have, again, at the ELCA, there's a young woman who was working on, I forget where she was, but she's quite young, and she told me one day when we were talking about simplicity that she was so shocked when she came to the ELCA for her interview, and HR gave her a plastic water bottle to drink out of. She almost thought that she wasn't going to take the job. She was so appalled to think that the ELCA churchwide was so benighted and behind that we would do that. And I don't think that, so I think that HR didn't hear that. But HR is one age. She's 23, so
yeah.
It's...
It's a fashion statement.
Is it still?
They all gone.
Where?
They had a gym.
Universities too. Kids bring in their class.
There's definitely moves afoot to outlaw them. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
What about safety when you go to third world countries and you don't know what water to drink?
Yeah.
And I feel so guilty.
Yeah.
Know? But what do you do?
Yeah.
I suppose you could get a bottle with a water filter, but again, is that 100%?
Well, you know, if you think about where plastic water bottles came from, they came from Europe and third world countries. So, you know, when you're on the train in Europe, it still says, you know, this isn't water, it's not potable water that comes out of the tap. So you have to have it.
Yes.
So the tradition was sort of supported by the infrastructure. And likewise, in places where water filtration isn't good, it's not. But I remember Walt and Alita, when I was presenting in Wisconsin last year, people were just remembering when you had that, how many millions of dollars Milwaukee put into its water system after that outbreak. And now you have like the best water in the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And then people still think, let's buy the...
Yeah, they're still afraid to drink it because...
Because that happened...
Because it happened in the... When was it? 1990 or something. Yeah, but it changed public health and public water systems throughout the country.
It did.
Yeah, because it was the biggest outbreak of a waterborne illness.
Mm.
So... yeah, but
my product from drinking water under that point.
However, I guess the other side of that is that, I mean, not everyone went then to individually bottled water. You probably see more of the larger, you know, 5 gallon
kind of Culligan
dispensers.
Yeah, it was too big to bring with me. So
yeah,
this is the one I have to introduce as my co-presenter
throughout the city. But
also in reference to traveling overseas, which I've done a bunch of, I also read somewhere that the suggestion of that we are so spoiled with the cleanliness that in the food and in the water that we consume. That when we go overseas, it was suggested to just drink what they drink, which makes me immediately sick for a long time. But then in time, your body's going to adjust, and you won't have to get the bottled water.
If you're there for 2 weeks, you can't do that. But if
right,
you're
so I haven't been brave enough to do that. But
yeah.
if you're, I mean, if that's something
yeah.
that,
yeah.
because we're so spoiled and, you know, everything's
yeah.
clean and everything has to be.
Oh, yeah. We forgot the value of sanitation and how.
Yeah.
So this is just an exercise in kind of looking at, you know, sort of culturally, when you think, how come we spend so much, or what do we do? It's just sort of an interesting way to kind of begin to unpack some of these things. So I have little notes that I've taken. If I'm going to go into lecture mode now. So I was identifying, as I thought about it, kind of three main elements of the lens, the way we make our choices and the way we see our lives. First was, you know, obviously we all value convenience. Often over sustainability, you know, drive-through lanes, takeout menus, labor-saving devices. We spend a lot of money and resources to make things faster or simpler, no matter what that cost is environmentally or in terms of time for us. There's a man named Garrett Kaiser who writes often, I think, for the Atlantic Monthly. He says, the very notion of convenience upon which our civilization rests is killing us environmentally. Another lens that we see through here is that, you know, and we see it every day, growth is the greatest good, right? I mean, this was a real moneymaker for the Coca-Cola company. And you have to ask for tap water now often in restaurants because they'd rather give you something else like this. So the lens that we look through economically values growth way more than economy or thrift. And we see that growth, you know, we need growth to prosper. Therefore, commodifying water is a really good thing. A couple of years ago at a Global Mission event that was in Massachusetts, there was a woman named Wahu Karu, who was a Nobel laureate, but she lost out to the lady who plants trees from Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
She too is from Kenya, and she had worked on indebted countries, the Jubilee for Indebted Countries. And so she said in her sermon there, she said, we live in an economic paradigm that does not allow us to manifest God, which I thought was a really profound statement.
Mm.
Another thing that this lens that might show us our culture is that the individual is more important than the group, right? Your individual
right.
water is more important than the collective, which came up in Sunitha's session yesterday when we were looking at individual cultures versus group cultures, which is something she's exploring tomorrow too in her sessions on mission culture. It's kind of left up to each of us to solve the problems or make our lives better. I was thinking, you know, solving things collectively. There's a long tradition of that in American culture, but it kind of gets harder, I think. And I've been here a little bit, so I'm not following healthcare, but there's an effort to try to make something a little more collective that's getting a lot of heat. I was interested to read that, you know, one reason why our national transportation system is so disjointed is because air, rail, and highway systems all have separate financing schemes. So it isn't even possible right now to bring all those things together to make any kind of a national plan that might end up yielding something that would make it easier to not live with a car or to live with a less of a car. So we kind of favor individual systems that are solutions that are faster rather than things that take a little longer. So those were kind of three lenses that I was thinking, well, you know, it's how we see our lives and it's part of what makes trying to live differently a little bit really feel like swimming upstream. So I was thinking, you know, what are some of the other alternate lenses we might look through and how can we get there? Carl Jung said something interesting that I think has made a difference to me. All the greatest and important problems of life are fundamentally insoluble. They can never be solved. They can only be outgrown, which is a really different way of looking at things. You know, real change results when we embrace a higher or a wider interest. So if we decided, okay, now, and you can kind of see glimmers of that, at least in terms of the need to green because of global warming. If that were to become a higher interest, it would really help a lot of us. The lens would change. We would start to see things differently, and it'd be a lot easier for all of us. Choices would start to be, the market would start to offer more choices that would make it easier for us to live lives inside a system that honored that. So I think it's interesting to think, how can we outgrow this? And there's another idea I came across that said, the creative process is simpler but more powerful than problem solving because it includes and transcends problems. So instead of thinking, let's solve that problem, let's imagine something different, and you can maybe go farther in that process. So, you know, so outgrowing our problems and trying to create new alternatives are two really interesting and powerful ways maybe that we as people in our culture can kind of move forward on changing our lens. There was an interesting lens-changing phrase I learned last year that probably everybody has heard. There is no away. You heard that? And we say, oh, let's throw it away. There is no away. As soon as you think there is no away, you never hear, let me just throw that away again the same way. So sometimes the things that change our lenses are really simple and open up ways to look for alternatives. It makes it a little simpler. I was also reflecting that there's a good example maybe around simple living or living green, or an example of a changed culture would be smoking. I remember in the eighth grade that my best friend's parents were adamant anti-smoking activists, and I was embarrassed by them because the culture was so honored the smoker. My parents didn't smoke, but to be with her parents, it was like, oh gosh, they're just like, this is just so embarrassing. You know, you're a teenager and you don't want that attention to be brought to you. But, you know, they were truly lone voices out there, and then you could just think, where has that gone since 1970? How much in almost 40 years has the whole pendulum swung the other way? So that kind of thing kind of gives me hope that maybe it, as we kind of think about structures and systems and values, that maybe there is something that can, there's more movement happening so that the people who want to recycle or would like to not always drive their car aren't always the people who aren't always marginalized. So then I was doing a little thinking about different, what some alternative lenses would be. This is, we're still in the lecture part of this lecture, okay? And then we'll get to the discussion part where we can all jump in. It would be interesting if we could replace our lens of convenience with a lens that appreciated time more. Last year when I was at Holden, I got the book Radical Simplicity from the bookstore, and I haven't quite finished it, but it's a pretty challenging book by a man named Jim Merkel. And so he said in there, to pilgrims faced with a continent of abundant resources, it was time that was scarce. You know, you had the whole continent to go out and plunder, but you only had 24 hours in a day. So now that we're kind of getting to a point where the resources are less abundant, is it possible for us to kind of to switch and not see that time is money, but the time is renewable and the resources aren't. It would be interesting. Maybe we can talk later if anybody succeeded in that. I think time is tough, but a new view on time would be an interesting lens for our culture to make. A few months ago in the New York Times, there was an article called "Are Bad Times Healthy?" This was last fall, right when the market was just going to pieces. So "Are Bad Times Healthy?" was the question that was asked in Science Times. And they cited a few things, one of which was that some years ago, the coffee market crashed in Colombia, and then babies got healthier. Why would that be? Because there was less, you didn't spend as much time growing coffee, you had more time to spend on the activities that make babies healthier, like holding them and walking them around and playing with them. And so there, it was an odd kind of a research result. But as less time was spent on work and more time was invested in just being with these children, the children were healthier. Now that's not true everywhere, I think, but it was an interesting thing. So it'd be great if we can think differently about time and convenience. Also, there's a critique. Our faith would critique that too. Is our personal convenience the standard against which Christians should be measuring everything? We might want to think about that. I don't think the Bible says that convenience is the greatest good, but we really live without questioning that, I think, in our lives because of the system that we live within. The second lens would be changing our lens on economic growth. And I know someone out there is working really hard to try to do that. If you think about, you know, there's already puts and calls, you can bet against the market and make money. Someone is out there, some PhD is going to win a Nobel Prize is figuring out how we can change our economic system to reward something different. Because if growth is it, we're really going to outstrip our resources and everything else. I'm not an economist. I'm speaking as someone who just reads and thinks about this. But it seems like someone is inventing that. There is already a field called ecosystem services. You're not, okay. Can you explain ecosystem services?
No, I know about it.
You know about it? I only read about it. There might be somebody here who like says, oh yeah, that's my job. Okay. Then we'll go back to what I read about it. The field of ecosystem services assigns bottom line economic value to existing ecosystems because they perform work that has bottom line value. So in other words, wetlands are valuable because they filter drinking water. And if the wetland went away, the cost of building the machine that would filter the water would be huge. So there actually is a small group of people who are like, I don't know how they're figuring out I can't, as someone who's been shaped by our economic market, I don't see how they pay themselves dividends for owning the wetlands, but somehow they are figuring out how to do that.
The analogy might be public or utility companies that encourage conservation because that's cheaper than building new facilities.
And
given that growth is unavoidable, uh-huh. There's just more people doing it.
So
you got to spread.
And somehow there's a model that.
And
somehow some states, I think in California, the utilities can benefit from.
There's an algorithm someplace that says it is worth this much to us to give away fluorescent light bulbs because we can.
Yeah.
And sell the electricity to a higher and better use without having to generate more.
So it's an interesting idea to think we could put our IRAs in wetlands or something, you know? But somebody in 1997, an economist quantified the value of nature's contributions to human economics, which he called nature's services, at $33 trillion, which was more than the world GNP at the time. Because if those services weren't around, to come up with man-made duplications would just be hugely expensive. So maybe someone is figuring out how we can make money from that. And then
also
finally,
that
yeah.
Make money, it's that you avoid money
money. So that it's an investment in something that doesn't actually yield the dividend, but prevents. So it's a different.
Like setting up forests so they hold water back, rather than building dikes on the rivers to stop the flooding.
So infrastructure wouldn't tend to just yield a profit, it would tend to lower its cost, is that it?
Okay. If you count all the costs, not
all the cost, and not just the
certain ones, yeah.
Right, and that's, we're probably seeing a shift towards that, don't you think, that businesses are
slowly
having to factor into their actual costs?
But if it's your cost you're saving and somebody else is paying for what you've done, then you know, most people say, so what?
It's externalities.
Yeah.
Until you can bring it in, then there's no cost.
Eventually, the challenge is how to identify and measure externalities. The obvious ones are obvious, but there's the unobvious ones aren't. How did you know that babies would get healthier when the coffee crop failed?
No. They didn't know that. It was sort of a surprise result.
It's an economic externality.
Yeah. Huh. I never heard that phrase, economic externality. Okay. I'll use that next time. That will make me sound smart, right? I'll go look it up first. And then there's the individualism lens. The lens that says it's good to carry a plastic water bottle. My colleague, Sunitha Mortha, who's not here right now.
She's next door.
Is she doing anyone next door? Okay, you had to choose.
No, she's attending next
door. Oh, she's attending next door. Oh, she's, okay.
She had to choose.
She had to choose. Oh, well, she's heard me talk on this before. when she was talking about cultures yesterday, saying, you know, she was noting that, you know, she says it often, that India is good at protecting the community and the U.S. is good at protecting the individual. So if she were in a situation, a legal situation, where she needed her rights protected, she would surely choose a U.S. lawyer, but in a situation where the community had to be protected, she would not choose a U.S. advocate to do that because we don't really know how to do that. So it would be interesting for us to see how our lens shifts more towards community and collaboration. When I first really learned the story of global warming 10 years ago, or 9 years ago here from Doug Carlson, who gave a whole week session. He was talking about how the good thing about global warming, like, is there anything? This cheered him up. He said, the good thing is it's an incredible opportunity for global cooperation. Mm. I don't know whether we're going down that road, but it isn't something that one country is going to be able to solve on its own. And so is Beth here today? Are you Beth? Who works at University of Minnesota. She's the coordinator now for this interdisciplinary program on sustainability and global warming. You know, they're also figuring out it's not a one discipline thing either. So maybe the good message around global warming is amazing opportunity for somebody to cooperate, for people to cooperate. Likewise, water. There's a Lutheran theologian from Canada who talks a lot about water conflict, who does a map and shows you like where around the world there are conflicts over the water. But again, for him, the good news is successful civil conflict resolution examples far outnumber people picking up guns and fighting about water. And so, you know, so long as if water too, conflict over water becomes an opportunity for people to collaborate or create new alternatives or outgrow the problem, that would be, maybe we'll be able to hear those messages more in our really individual culture. And really, if you think about it, a lot of collaboration is already built in. I mean, you know, I don't have to filter my own water because my public water system does it for me. I don't have to, well, now with email, it's different, but, you know, didn't have to. I could put a stamp on it. We can put stamps on envelopes and they go places. There's a fair amount. Our structure does support collaboratively delivering a lot of services to us. So it'll be interesting to see how maybe that enlarges a little bit around us, especially around that transportation thing. So interesting to think of air, water, rail, they all have separate financing, tax systems, and governances. I hope someone is going to start figuring out.
We're already seeing that, the elimination of transportation through video conferencing, for example.
Yeah. So the need,
so the
same thing,
shift.
Investing in that instead of in the airplane ticket.
Yeah.
Huh.
There's another example of the economy being good for us.
Mm.
In my company, they just said, we're cutting those travel budgets 30%.
Yeah,
you're gonna have to
figure out another way. Yeah, stay home.
Prioritize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll get to carbon footprints tomorrow and travel. So, the last of my lecture part here is just to say, I think it's interesting for us as people who are living in the system to understand the lens that we look through. If we kind of start seeing, in what way are we seeing convenience, are the things, the products that we buy and the way that we live influenced by the fact that we see these first? And what, you know, can we kind of look at these other ways of looking at the world as a way to open up more space for us to find alternatives, ways to live? This there's always a large debate, I find, in the sort of simple living movement between the people who believe, the people who believe that individual changes will add up to societal change, and the people who refuse that and say, no way, it's all about legislation and advocacy. There's really two distinct camps. And I feel like the power of the individual is amplified when you can kind of link up to a movement or a source of power. But you read a lot about, you know, communities who are trying to turn themselves into green communities, but they can legislate all they want. At the bottom, it's how individuals are living their lives that are keeping them from being green or not. So there's a powerful connection, I think, between our own choices and our ability to seek through legislation and policy changes that surround us. You kind of have to do a both and. I was here last winter for 1 week, and there was a lot of snow. It was my first winter at Holden Village. And one day I came out, and Don Coffey, are you here, Don? Okay, was walking down the path from the Arc over to Chalet 2, but she was, instead of walking down the path, she was like walking sideways against the snow, pushing back the whole way with her boots. I said, well, Don, what are you doing? She was stomping. She said, well, this is how I make the path bigger for other people. And that really made me think, well, the role, I think, of the individual could be, and it just, you thought, Don, what the heck are you doing that for? Just walk down the path. Stop doing that. But her choice to do that was making space for other people to use that same path later. So if we kind of think of our own lives as we seek alternatives for our own way of living, is, you know, sometimes you're really just making the path bigger for other people, and maybe someday it'll be a highway as we change lens. So that's kind of the lecture portion of this discussion, and now I can just sort of ask questions and write down ideas. I probably should have been asking questions all along. But if you have the lenses then of, does anybody want to talk about how these lenses affect their own lives or their own choices? Individual lens or growth lens or convenience lens? How are you affected by that? Oh, I forgot to say yesterday what I said, which is I just assume simple living is good, and I start from there. So we're not talking about why. So I'm assuming some of you are looking for some changes in your lives to slow down, use less, have more time for something else. I'm just assuming the people who come to Holden often have that. So around these lenses of convenience, individualism, growth, anybody? Sir?
Well, just hopping in your car anytime you want something to go somewhere, to go get it. Mm-hmm. Rather than trying to figure out a way that you could either take alternate transportation or combine some things and minimize the trips.
So are you doing that?
A little bit.
Mm-hmm. How have you, like, what steps have you taken?
Well, I take the bus more than I used mm-hmm. to. You can get around pretty well.
What, are you from Seattle? Were you?
Yeah, Seattle.
Okay. Did you, when you started to do that, did you know the numbers of the bus that you needed to take, or did you have to go through a process of learning the bus number that served your neighborhood?
It was pretty obvious before.
Okay.
Went somewhere.
Oh. I think for a lot of people, that's like, if you're not a public transit person, you just kind of see the bus, but you don't really kind of know, like, how do you get around your own city? And I know a man who works for Church World Service who decided that one day a week he was going to try to take the bus from home to his office. And it was a complete learning process. This is Modesto, not a town with a lot of public transportation, but A, there was a bus. B, the bus was convenient. This was the number of the bus, this is how you paid for the bus, and that's how you took it. It's a whole learning process. It's for most of us. So it's so great. Yeah, okay, alternatives. That definitely makes space for other people when you're taking the bus, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just going to say, I live on the peninsula, the Olympic Peninsula, mm-hmm. and
it has rich valleys that are being turned into big box stores. So there's a struggle to buy that land because farmland is it's inexpensive and it's not being preserved. So but it's such a political struggle, and trying so hard to raise crops on that land and sell those crops to, you know, at markets and to the schools, which again then cuts down on transportation and so on. But as you watch that, it's, you know, people just call the, you know, call the people home with granolas, you know, and there's a lot of disrespect, I guess, and it's just a struggle right now.
The market thing, I think, is interesting. You know, I think this is where colleges, a lot of them, are unhooking and saying, you know, once a week we're going to try to source local food and offer a market, because all, you know, Sodexo and all those other places aren't relating at all to a local market. So we, you know, what maybe where there was a more natural link between schools and local farmers, that's something that people, I think, are putting energy in. So they're trying to do that. And
very much, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's quite a group that are also writing into their ownership of the land that it will not be sold for anything other but, you know, the aquarium kind of.
So it's a conservancy or
land?
It's what?
Land trust.
It's a land trust, yeah. Land
yes,
trust.
A conservancy. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I always like to look at signs of hope, you know, where can we learn something different from what other people are doing?
Well, kind of the conflict I see, we've got a son at Luther College 1 year, he just was there 1 year, and during the year we got letters, which was wonderful, from the president, we're doing what we can to keep costs down, and then we just found out they've decided to go with Sodexo.
Oh.
Go with what?
Sodexo, it's a food service company, Sodexo, that S-O-D-E-X-H-O, it's Portuguese, I think.
You know, and so, they have, and I don't know the specifics, but I was sorry to hear that.
But I wonder if Sodexo has a desk now where the someone who, so they, if colleges like St. Olaf are saying, we're going to unhook from you once a week to do something local, I wonder if Sodexo is starting to find local market experts.
Maybe.
I wonder, anybody from the food industry here?
No, but we did talk to one of the people from Luther College last week, because there was a group here about that, and I had the same reaction, and
yeah.
He said, well, they wrote the contract such that it would fit with Luther's, you know, Luther's trying to go green as one of the wards, and they wrote the contract and found a manager that had been doing it at another college.
Oh, great.
Okay.
So they're hoping that will work.
Yeah.
But they're still skeptical.
See, that was what was frustrating me at the ELCA last year. It's like, come on, change. But then you forget, it's a big building. There's a lot of people working there. There's a contract involved. But when they start hiring the people who know that, so they were looking at caterers and how the caterers are using their, how do they get their food? How do they recycle stuff? What do they do? It's interesting. But it's like, I'm sort of like still stuck on one can, one recycling thing. So I get impatient with things like that, but it's really good to hear what's really happening.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes. Yes, you were next.
In Minnesota, and I know it's happening throughout the country, and I can't talk about colleges, but I can speak to public schools, that they're doing a lot more. In Minnesota, we call it farm to school.
Ah,
it's
that's
very
good.
Much of that kind of thing where school districts are working with local farmers, local being those within maybe a 100-mile radius or something such as that,
mm-hmm.
and able to collaborate on providing local goods and
mm-hmm.
services to
mm-hmm.
the school.
Mm-hmm. Is it, how about people like going to farmers market or anybody here trying to focus on, just raise your hand if you try to buy food in season for your local growers.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have a restaurant doing the same thing. They advertise that they only use products.
Yeah. Local. And how many of you were doing that 5 years ago? And how about 10 years ago? So some people, but okay. So see, you can see that's great. Yes, Barbara.
Well, do you think maybe we should just start with yourself?
Yeah.
I mean, all this stuff is is wonderful what I hear, but if you live within a mile of a market and you want a loaf of bread, you walk or you jump in your car. It's that simple to me. It has to start, I believe, there and with each individual.
There is
globally, but what about me?
Yes, we can, but I was just trying to point out the ways in which we're not supported in doing that. But we can, and they've talked about there's like some triangle of public health. Like, if we all just decided not to use the car for trips of less than a mile and walked instead, how much less gas we'd use, how many pounds we'd drop. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a place where like public health and environment actually intersect in a way that's, but you're not hearing a lot about that yet. I read it in a study, so it's not really being promoted, but it would be great. And people who walk less for trips less than a mile or for very short trips you can tell me a story.
Back to your conversation about the use of time.
Yeah, okay.
It's not a binomial equation.
No, there's a third thing of time. Mm-hmm. Right, so there's time, gas, and
effort,
right. Sort of how it works there. Dan.
A lot of these personal changes like this are hard to do because you have to establish a new habit. And I think people, when you do something like that, it's not a popular word, but you have to make a sacrifice. Like the new way of doing it, the simpler way, is ultimately more enjoyable and all that. But there is, people do have to realize that they are, you know, sacrificing something that they're used to. Mm-hmm. And the sacrifice is really just psychological, you know, it's like you have to get over that hump. But I think, just to give an example, in Portland for years now, well, since about 2002, there's been a group called Shift to Bikes, and which is sort of a memberless organization, but it has like fun bike events just to get people on bikes,
mm-hmm.
like providing breakfast on the bridges for people who bike through, and mm-hmm. fun social rides for people, like sort of, so people aren't making a big leap, they're doing something that's fun, and then it's like helping them establish a habit.
A habit. The structure is going around it, so it's easier to do it.
The notion of sacrifice is interesting because it's perceptual. If I have a healthier heart and I lose weight because I walk,
is it a sacrifice? That's why Thursday our topic is it sacrifice? What's the positive message about that? Because we go to sacrifice really quickly, in part because that's is
if
it a market
thing? If I give up convenience for time that I don't have, now maybe I'm sacrificing something.
We were making a joke about holding food last night that, you know, it's not simple. It takes a lot of time. But so the ho-ho is easier, right? But it's the simpler. Going to buy the ho-ho is easier than baking the bread and all the chopping the vegetables. But what about the outcome? I'm going to go to the back. People towards the back. Hello.
Hey, I wanted to say something about the walking a mile to the store.
Yeah.
That really depends on what that mile is like between you and the store.
Yes,
if you're walking a suburban mile through parking lots, that's what they're called.
Yeah.
And it's not parking lots. And this really cruddy places to walk with no sidewalks. You know, I'm not going to walk a mile to the store. I walk to the store constantly, but I'm not going to do it in that sort of place. There's a website I just want to mention, maybe you guys know it. It's called walkscore.com.
Walk what?
Walkscore.
Score, S-C-O-R-E?
S-C-O-R-E, yeah.
Okay.
And my husband and I are looking to buy a house or townhouse or some sort of living unit, and we walkscore every place that we look for in the market.
Yeah.
And it tells you, it goes from car dependent to
car independent or whatever.
Walker's Paradise, and it shows you
like that.
If it's where the grocery stores are, where the schools are, where the market just anything you possibly want.
That's nationwide.
Yeah, you can walk score any place you want.
You mean the data is there so you can just find out your own community? It's already there? Or it's a grid you use to judge your community?
There's different ways to use the site. You can go and type in an address, and it'll tell you the walk score for that address. Or
really?
You can go, say, other than Seattle, you want to, like, find the best places to live, so you bring up the Seattle map, and, like, there's shading to tell you, like, where the best places are to live.
How is it even by sidewalks?
Well, it's not a perfect sort of system. They talk about a little bit on the,
In Chicago, there was something like that that, you know, started about 15 or even 20 years ago that wasn't, they weren't even looking at environment, but they were looking, Loyola University was offering, was subsidizing its employees to buy two flats and houses around Loyola University to drive, to lower their commute. Not for environmental reasons, but because economic developers in Chicago were trying to figure out ways to say, what's the benefit of a dense old city neighborhood? And that's what they came up with. And then they were trying to convince banks then, in offering mortgages to these people, that they should be, their creditworthiness should be evaluated differently, because if they only had to have one car or no car, therefore then they had more money to spend on the mortgage. So that was a really creative thing, and I don't know what's happening in the current market for mortgages, but there was a real push to say city people should be evaluated differently because they don't have to put so much money into trucks and cars, and they can spend differently on their houses. Thank you, that's really interesting. Yes, ma'am.
Talking about how you can make a difference and how things do change, think of what has happened probably where you live, just like where we live, with bags instead of plastic bags. I mean, I remember 10 years ago, you know, I would bring my bags. Of course, I'm European and I have thousands of these cloth bags, and they would just take it and they just kind of look at it, like, you know, the second, and many times I would say, I'll second myself, and now I see so many people bringing them, and or people making comments when I put mine down, oh, I forgot mine today, and then I will say, well, you know, you kind of get used to it, and what I'm doing now is training myself to take them in department stores, because there's plastic sacks too, it's not just groceries, but you really have to train yourself to do that, but it's happening.
There's a young woman who's been here at Holden a lot who I hope to achieve this level of awareness, but when she goes out to eat, she takes her own Tupperware. So she
I'm
can take all
I'm
her stuff without getting
yep.
the styrofoam thing, and I never remember. So, but that you really have to remember. I've got to put the bag thing down. I don't have the Tupperware thing down. But think about that. Okay, let's go to you and then you.
Okay.
And then
two things.
Oh, and then back to Terry.
A lot of you are in university communities, and maybe they do this already where you are. But they came in, and you know, all college students at the end of the year just throw all kinds of things in dumpsters. Well, the group came in, took all that stuff, went to the Notre Dame Stadium, had a huge garage sale, and donated the profits to charity. They made $75,000. And they sold, like, computers for $50 or $5. And so people, and the line was fantastic. The other thing that happened, and we switched from recycling bins to the roll-out carts because it's so much recycling. They took the old, they asked us to return our bins, and people from Goshen College went to the grade schools and the high schools, and when the kids cleaned out their lockers at the end of the year, asked them to put everything that somebody else could use, or jackets or sweaters or, you know, whatever it might be, mirrors, in there, and they're going to redistribute those.
So there they're kind of building this infrastructure for sharing that somebody identified yesterday didn't exist. So now that's interesting.
Yeah, and I thought it was kind of interesting, the recycling
bins. It's walking sideways against
the
snow.
You know, it's cloth bags that grocery stores have very convenient ways to handle the plastic bags and a rack that holds it while they throw the stuff in.
Yeah.
With cloth bags, they're fumbling around trying to figure out how to hold this
thing
and put stuff in it.
But more of them are selling them, so eventually they're going to figure out how to do that. Okay, sorry, Terry. I keep ignoring you.
I can point from, like, specific examples to, like, while you were asking the question about how the powers and principalities maybe limit our what we'd like to do, is that correct, and sustainability? And I'm just thinking about, or wanted to offer just what we're given from the powers and principalities about what it means to matter in terms of corporations and that what we see in advertising and how that informs how we matter and if that changed. For example,
Go for it. Come on.
Okay. Our language, too, in that all of this, so even the assumption about sustainability being good, sort of creates this right-wrong thing. And
yeah.
I think we all believe in the need for sustainability. But how can we do that holding each person's journey and with respect, you know, not saying, well, I'm more right because I do this, or, you know, just being very respectful in a way that encourages everybody.
I feel like when it comes to simple living or green living, there is no one-size-fits-all thing, because it depends entirely on what your life is like, where you live, and what things you're doing. So, yeah, I shouldn't have been standing next to that garbage can scowling at colleagues with tan cans, because maybe there was something else they were doing that was really great. So if you do sort of get focused on one part and get snippy, I'm a snippy person in recovery, trying not to do that anymore. But, you know, I was missing the rest of their lives and just focusing on this one little thing that didn't look right to me. Got to relax and let go.
Well, I'm also mindful of the powerful, of the power that being an example can be. Mm-hmm. If you just go in, I mean, Starbucks is just an example, I think. They're slow at catching on to the green. But if you look at the trash can Starbucks, of all the different cups, that people use and then just leave. Where you could bring your own cup in and save 10 cents every time, or they have cups there that you can use. And just, it starts really small, and refusing to drink bottled water, for example. Okay. And then people ask questions and they wonder, why are you doing this? So it can begin some good conversation.
And then it is making the habit. Like, I completely always forget to bring my travel mug with me to Starbucks when I'm at a Starbucks and decide, so I have a, I mean, just, it's, I think that's really great, and I wonder what percentage of people are really doing it. Maybe 5%?
Well, it's interesting, because I do that now, and they know my name. They all know my name, and they all know what I want. I'm a regular.
So, you've
but
really
a lot of it, too,
built
is
that
because I bring my own cup, and they expect
they
that.
Remember your cup.
But it's really, mm-hmm. it's little stuff like that, I think,
mm-hmm.
is really big.
You know, we've been a member of a CSA for 15 years. And
CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, do you know? Okay.
And Milwaukee has a wonderful co-op, and we shop pretty much exclusively there because it's, you know, more connected to sustainability, but it's more expensive. Now, that co-op is trying to get into the schools, and their catering division, and work with the schools and locally sourced fresher foods. And it's very difficult because they can't be competitive economically. And of course, the schools are so underfunded to begin with, they're not gonna. So I think there's a whole structural thing there.
Yeah.
The other comment I have
one.
Is that, you know, I can do those. And I can afford to go to the more expensive co-op and purchase healthier food. At the same time, I'm writing grants for our local food pantry, and the stuff we give away is not healthy food
mm-hmm.
to the people. And so, I feel a real tension there around that. I mean, I can choose to live simply, even if it costs me more in money or in time, but I have the ability to choose
to do that.
That
right.
Whereas
yeah.
there's this huge,
yeah.
very poor segment of our city and most cities that
there
don't have
do
the ability
yeah.
to choose.
Yeah. There's a lot, if you kind of read Barbara Kingsolver or Michael Pollan,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a whole lot more stuff. More books are coming out that are looking at the way our food system is structured and subsidized, and how giant subsidies for soybeans and
mm-hmm.
corn lead to corn syrup,
mm-hmm.
lead to cheap food, lead to so that the stuff that does get given away through government surplus programs is
mm-hmm. and they
not
also
that
are the
great.
Uninsured who are very unhealthy.
Yeah.
So it's a very complex.
Because it's cheaper to buy that
issue.
Box of Cheetos than.
Uh-huh.
So that's and there's a big structure thing.
Cheap,
that's
mac and cheese.
That how is that going to change? I don't know, but if anybody, like that's another session. Food economics, mm-hmm. economics, sir and man.
I'm curious. My congregation, all of us probably, most of us, represent some congregation, Lutheran congregation. in my congregation, every Sunday morning, we serve coffee. And guess what we drink it out of?
Styrofoam.
We do too.
And we go through about 300 cups a Sunday, maybe 1,000, I don't know.
Is it fair trade coffee?
Yes. I think it might be fair trade coffee, but
still
I hope so.
Yeah.
But in styrofoam cups. I'm curious. This became a small issue in our council meeting this spring, and I think it will come up again. What are other congregations doing in this regard? I mean,
Okay, sure. And I have two examples. One is like what happened, how somebody changed it, and also how we outgrew it. I did notice about, you all who were here yesterday heard this, the young woman from my congregation who just, she's about 32, she just started showing up with her mug, her ceramic mug, every Sunday. And then she would put it away, and then she'd bring it out. So I thought, oh, I'm just going to watch and see what happens. That little individual act met another larger force when our congregation decided to, like, you know, reevaluate and do a new mission statement. And the new mission statement was like, we are a green space in the city. Well, once you decide you're a green space in the city, you kind of are. You're not problem solving. You're creating something new and learning a higher good. If that's your standard, then all of a sudden when someone says, you know, we got to get some new toilet cleaner, can you go get that really great Ajax, or can we order more styrofoam? Suddenly there was a principle against which the council was able to say, well, if we're a green space, how does styrofoam work? If we're a green space, why are we using toxic chemicals in the bathroom? It's been slow, but it was interesting since the church itself identified this as what they wanted to put in the mission statement. It just built in the accountability and changed the lens for how all of the purchasing decisions were made. So I'd say now we offer some, not styrofoam anymore, they're insulated paper cups and ceramic, and there's still people who want to have it in paper, just like some people will never take the common cup. Is there what? Oh yeah, don't you think every church has a whole set of stoneware? I think the other thing was that there's the justice issue there is who washed all those dishes all those years, right? The same young woman said, I don't care, I'll find the glass communion cups. She brought back the glass communion cups and she instituted a schedule of washing them. But the women who for decades were just assumed to have been the ones who were gonna wash the mugs and the glasses every week, were released from that. I mean, that's why we went to styrofoam, I'm sure. It was like, do I have to wash one more dish for the church? I think it was sort of that. But so this one young woman really just did change the system twice. But the mission statement was sort of made that grow space. You know, it's not a problem to solve, it's something new to live up to. And that released a lot. And we're not perfect. I make it sound like we are. No.
What precipitated the council to looking at the mission statement?
Oh, yeah, your basic small, shrinking urban congregation that's wondering what to do next.
Okay.
So
it wasn't the green piece, but as they started to...
It was sort of as they went through this whole value clarifications process to figure out, like, what are the values we seem to be living, and then how does that meet the gospel? And I was sort of more on the fringes of it. I didn't lead it, but, yeah, the stress of having a small, underfunded urban congregation made them look at that.
Our congregation...
Wait, did I say I would call it? Yes, back there, I think it was...
Going back to what she said about the economic resistance toward, you know, like moving toward green options and living in other parts of the country, because I went to Georgia for a while and then went to Alaska, and they're just very anti, I guess it's environmental cleanliness or sanitation, or, you know, being from Seattle, it's just so natural now to, you know, have those options, even on like a ferry or in a terminal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you mentioned something and you just kind of get snapped at in Georgia and in Alaska because it costs too much to recycle. And they don't have those places for you to even dispose of something that, you know, naturally you kind of feel guilty about throwing away.
So
and
in some...
economic resistance to something like in Seattle, where most people are pretty conscientious of being green, but there's like a radio advertisement against the bank tax. And then, you know, a lot of people are starting to use their own bags, and IKEA doesn't have, you know, you kind of have to pay anyway for bags, because they've done that in Sweden for so long. And then, I don't know, they do that at Trader Joe's, but it's like you're encouraged to take your own bag, but people don't want to pay 20 cents
to do it,
because it's like they're some sort of a freedom or something.
that's something what she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it goes back to like this girl's talking about education and language. Because you just said there's resistance to the bag tax.
Oh,
well, this is
yes.
What, this is an interesting
sure.
word. It's a charge if you are going to use plastic bags in the grocery stores. So the people who are against it have now turned it the bag
tax.
And so when I was home last week, I got a phone call saying, are you, you know, we have an election coming up. Are you for the bag tax? And I said, what, tax? I said, yes, I am. Hung up. Well, you know, this is it. It's language.
Yeah.
Language plays
yeah.
a huge role in how we
yeah. That's like Thursday. We'll look like, what's the positive about simplicity? Maybe we shouldn't call it simplicity. We should call it something else. What time is it?
Quarter to half.
Okay, can we go 5 or 10 more minutes? Okay. All right. Then it'll be dinner time, and I'll go wash dishes. Yes.
So I would like to speak in favor of capitalism and things like economic resistance.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest to you that what we're talking about is value choices that individuals make that accumulate. And in fact, the market is very responsive and efficient,
Amen.
Depending
mm-hmm.
upon what you tell it. And let me give you one example. I'm on the board of an organization called Northwest Responsible Investments, okay? And what we do is we take the shares that our congregations own. You know, most of your congregations have retirement funds, right? Lots of money, and they own lots of shares. What are your congregations doing mm-hmm. at those annual shareholder meetings? You know what we're doing? We're getting multiple denominations together, and we go in and say, we don't want, and one of our biggest things has been genetically modified
mm-hmm.
organisms, but we've been very effective in getting stores, for instance, big, huge corporations. They're very responsive if you give them the input, but you have to make that value
mm-hmm.
judgment and then get together and move.
Yes, shareholder act, it's big, and it's an asset, right? It's something you can do that does magnify, but I just still worry about, like, you know, what about if the bottom line is growth and the growth involves raw resources, how does the market at the bottom shift so that...
So the bottom line is
I just,
growth.
What would you say?
The bottom line is never growth.
You don't think so?
We've chosen that.
Yeah.
The bottom line is efficiency and profit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Huh.
It's always about profit.
Huh.
And that depends on people's values.
So
what will you pay more for? Will you pay more?
But if it's consuming less, how would we be? I mean, I have stocks, okay? And I agree, but I feel like it's sort of a paradox. How I read someone saying, you know what, we are not going to be able to shop our way out of this one. I read that. That was from an extreme commentator saying, you know, buy all the green products you want. We can't shop our way out of this. Something has to change. It's very fundamental about how we consume and use resources. So how does the market absorb that?
Let me just ask you. You have a 401k.
Yeah, and it's entirely in social screen funds.
Now, I was going to say, you've made a choice
yeah.
to go into a mutual fund that
mm-hmm.
has a conscience.
Mm-hmm.
Have we all?
I
think
know.
Of the difference that would make.
Mm-hmm. I
make
love to vote.
Choices every day.
I have some DuPont stock that my father-in-law gave to my son. And I, basically, like, if it was sponsored by a nun, I'll vote yes, because the nuns are always out there saying, no, they are the big shareholder activists. So we read those what do they call them that you get? The prospectus, or the one that comes when you're supposed to vote your shares.
The proxy.
If the nun said, and the company says, please don't vote for this one, and a nun said yes, I said, okay, that's for me. Whatever the sister says, I'll go for it.
That's our little Northwest Center for Responsible Investment. It's mostly nuns.
I think Dave Messenbring is coming next week, who's from an Episcopalian church in Seattle, and he talked about a fund that you could decide whether you want 1% or 2% or 3% back, but the money, it's like an alternative investing in international, like small loans and stuff around the world. Maybe if he's coming, I hope he'll talk about that, because it was interesting. I just think, how do we make money and do less? I don't know how. It's a big question. That's why I said someone's inventing that. We just don't know yet. But, you know, if Starbucks has to keep opening new branches to make money, what stops that? How do we...
We have been companies that are not looking at that, like Patagonia, and they're looking at the three and four P's, where they really see that smaller is better, and they uh-huh. and they're going to focus on doing it better, not more.
Huh.
And they're beginning to really.
So that's the efficiency and profit thing. Okay.
People and profit, because that's really where the profit comes from. If you so getting into that, so there are companies in Patagonia. I just mentioned that as one of the leaders in that, really looking at the value and how to do better, not more.
I think it's an area where there's a lot of creativity that we can hold. And I, you know, I didn't even get to take economics in high school because I was a senior, and they said it's a freshman class and you can't take it. So I feel woefully, woefully uneducated in that area. But it seems to me that a lot of smart people do a lot of smart work there. And I'd love to see more sessions on economics and simplicity and consumption, because I'd like to hear that explored more.
Since I have been in my 20s and age, there's been a thing about taking a little coffee shop like Starbucks or a cafe, and then they start growing because it's so popular, and then they grow and grow and grow and grow. Well, now I will not eat at any of those places. I only go to the mom and pop type of places, if there is one. And I think it's like, it's not that they're not good, maybe, but it's taking up all that space, and then the Denny's goes out of business, and then it becomes crummy looking, or whatever store run. And it's a kind of thing of just educating yourself that there's something other than stopping on the vacation or the road trip or the business trip. And I see people going into a coffee shop not far from my home, in line with the big SUV running, burning up all that gas to get coffee to go. And it's just learning a different way.
Yeah, it's
life.
The easiest. It's what's set up for our convenience, so it's absolutely the easiest to do. And so when you start to think, is that how I want to do it? It takes a lot more effort right now. Maybe there'll be a way that, you know, eventually there's less effort.
I think we have to keep telling stories and being in community.
And doing what you're doing, which is saying it's a value to me to sponsor, it's a value to me that small independent businesses live, therefore I will spend my money that way. And then right there, then explaining why. That's acting instead of throwing up your hands, which would be another bottom line for me. Always act. Don't throw up your hands. Or don't only throw up your hands. So, probably we should let you go to supper. So tomorrow is sort of looking at green stuff. You know, again, I'm not an economist, and we talked about economics. I'm not an engineer or a biologist, and we'll talk about climate change tomorrow. But I'm basically going to kind of give a speech that I heard a year ago on Earth Day by a weatherman. And weathermen specialize in taking complicated information and turning it into something you can use. So I thought that this weatherman's speech on climate change was the best I'd ever heard, so I took great notes, and I'll give that to you tomorrow. And then we can kind of talk about, you know, based on what the weatherman said, what are some things we could be doing that, you know, what has big impact, what has negligible impact, and how can we kind of ask questions about that. And then Thursday is, we'll look at language, like, should we not call it, you know, voluntary simplicity? Oh, excuse me. You know, is there a whole nother way to talk about what's happening that gives it a better, so it's not the bad tax, but something positive? And some of the questions that it's Leslie, right? No, I'm sorry, in the gray T-shirt. Terry, right? Terry, sorry. Your questions about beauty that last night on the porch, there were a lot more discussion about that, so maybe we can get back to that, too. For positive. So have dinner, have a good evening. See you tomorrow. Thank you. Buy the book, they want to sell the books.